Welcome back to Midpoint, my friends, on January 28th, 2026. Yesterday was International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It is a commemoration of the day that the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration and extermination camp was liberated by the Russian army. We will be talking today in a few minutes with my guests, Eric B. Stillman, the president and CEO of the Florida Holocaust Museum, and Elke Cumming, the senior vice president of the Gulf Coast Jewish Family and Community Services Organization, which has a support program for Holocaust survivors. But first, a few thoughts on current events and how they relate to Florida. If you are a regular listener, then you know that I am a person with a lot of opinions. I'm grateful for this platform that I've been given on WMNF to express them. Of course, the opinions I express are my own alone and do not necessarily represent the views of WMNF or the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation, which holds our broadcast license, nor do they necessarily reflect the views of my guests. But I don't think I'm going out on a limb here when I say that we are all united in our outrage and our sadness over the shooting. No, let me be more precise, over the state-sanctioned murder of in Minneapolis of Alex Preti, an American citizen, an ICU nurse who cared for veterans, and a person who was murdered, the evidence shows, as he was simply observing an ICE enforcement action while exercising his constitutional rights. I don't think there's anyone who would disagree that this is a heartbreaking tragedy. But I have some other thoughts, too. In the Tampa Bay region, it is close to freezing today, but we still have only limited sightings of ice in the Tampa Bay area. Why is that, you may ask? Well, think about what we've learned about ICE enforcement efforts since the murder of Alex Preti. Following that completely senseless, violent tragedy, Tampa's own Pam Bondi, the United States Attorney General, sent a warning letter to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, telling him that if he wanted ICE to leave his state, he had to do three things. Number one, he had to share state records on Medicaid and SNAP programs and the recipients of those programs with the federal government. Number two, he had to repeal any sanctuary policies, including permitting ICE to interview all detainees in state custody about their immigration status. And number three, and this is the kicker that tells the tale, he had to give the Federal Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division access to Minnesota's voter rolls. That extortionist demand made it crystal clear that the ICE violence, the chaos, the dangers that the Trump regime has brought to Democratic-led states was never about immigration. It was never about public safety. It was always about bringing blue states to heel, controlling them, and making sure that they never voted Democratic again, especially not in the upcoming midterm elections. This is pure fascism and right out of Hitler's playbook. Hitler had his brown shirts. Trump and Bondi have ICE. Oregon, Illinois, and especially Minnesota are the places and test cases for using violence and fear to try to control a population that has consistently refused to bend the knee to Trumpism and the Trump regime. Let's look at the facts. Minnesota is one of more than 20 states that has refused to comply with a demand from the United States Department of Agriculture to turn over personal information about people who have applied for SNAP or food stamp benefits. Those states have sued, and they've argued that the demand is unlawful, and a federal judge in California has issued a preliminary ruling in their favor. Minnesota is also one of the 22 states that have sued to block the Department of Health and Human Services from sharing sensitive Medicaid data with the Department of Homeland Security to aid immigration enforcement efforts. A different federal judge in California has ruled that only limited data can be shared, like addresses and immigration status. And it's not the first time that the Department of Justice has sought Minnesota's voter information, but it is the latest escalation in the Trump regime's nationwide attempt to consolidate data and gain unprecedented oversight into the country's voting systems, which are, by law, supposed to be controlled by the states, not by the federal government. The Trump regime is currently suing Minnesota and about two dozen other states, all states where Trump lost in the 2020 election, trying to compel those states to share unredacted voter lists with the federal government. So far, those Trump lawsuits to gain control over voting in the Democratic states have not been successful in any court anywhere. So Trump and Bondi figured out a new play, extortion. As Minnesota's chief voting official, Democrat Steve Simon, observed, quote, "It is deeply disturbing that the U.S. Attorney General would make this unlawful request a part of an apparent ransom to pay for our state's peace and security," close quote. Let's be blunt. This is a mobster's move. Nice little state you've got yourself there. It'd be too bad if something happened to it. That's the kind of thing we're hearing from the Trump regime. And what they are asking for is unlawful, it is outrageous, and it is reprehensible for the federal government to send untrained, violent, and in many cases criminal thugs into Democratic communities to sow violence and terror and fear, not for proper law enforcement or immigration purposes, but to stir up chaos and extort them. Now ask yourself, why aren't we seeing this kind of activity in Florida? Why? Well, because there's no need of it here. We are now going into our third decade of a Republican-controlled state government. The Republican-controlled state legislature has rolled over like a dog to pass every kind of law you can imagine, and some you didn't, to mandate local law enforcement cooperation with immigration enforcement here. In Florida, it's even against the law if they don't cooperate. They've already restricted SNAP benefits, limited and refused to expand Medicaid benefits, gerrymandered our voting districts until it is almost impossible for a Democrat to win everywhere, anywhere, and every year they've made it impossible and much harder for Florida citizens to vote already. What more could the Trump regime possibly hope to get out of Florida that it hasn't already gotten? You want to know where's ICE in Florida? Just quietly doing their thing. They're here. It's just not with the chaos and violence that we've seen in Minnesota and some of these other Democratic-led states. There's no reason to terrorize Floridians. Florida Republicans already traded away democracy and good government. That's why we are privileged to avoid the violence of Minnesota right now. But we should still be prepared. The Florida ACLU is holding a virtual training for legal observers on Tuesdays and Fridays at noon. You do not have to be a lawyer to take this legal observer training. You can join by going to mobilize.us/ACLU/event. Online. Look for RAISE, R-A-I-S-E, Legal Observer Training, or contact D. Gomez, all lowercase, D. Gomez, at aclufl.org. All right, let's get on with the show today, commemorating yesterday's Holocaust Day of Remembrance. I want to welcome my guests, Mr. Eric B. Stillman, President and CEO of the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg, that has just undergone a very big renovation and expansion project that he's going to share with us. So welcome to Midpoint, Eric Stillman.
Thank you, Shelley. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Elke Cumming is with us from the Gulf Coast Jewish Family and Community Services Organization. Among many other social services they provide in our community, they also have a program that supports our neighbors who are Holocaust survivors. And we are going to hear about that today. So welcome, Elke Cumming.
Thanks for having me join your conversation today.
Let me start with you, Eric. Tell us about the new changes and the expansion to the Florida Holocaust Museum. You've made quite a lot of new exhibits and education programs going on right now. So what can we see if we get to the museum?
Shelley, I encourage all of your listeners to come visit the Florida Holocaust Museum in downtown St. Petersburg. There have been remarkable changes in the period of time from July 2024 until September of 2025. We had a major renovation, the first major renovation in the history of the museum at this location. We revitalized our core exhibition, History, Heritage, and Hope, which tells the story of the Holocaust. We also introduced the Danish fishing boat Thor, which was used in the actual rescue of Danish Jews in 1943 during the Holocaust in World War II.
Yeah, I want to hear more about that. You know, several years ago, Midpoint did a show with Rachel Cerati about her grandmother's journey as a Czech teenage refugee who fled to Denmark during the war and was one of the people that was, taken over to Denmark in these fishing boats that saved almost all of the Jewish population of Denmark, right?
Yes, it's incredible that in a very short period of time, literally about a week or so, and over 7,000 Jewish residents of Denmark and almost 700 of their non-Jewish family members and household members were rescued, brought out under the cloak of darkness to Sweden, which was neutral at that time, so it was safety to get to Sweden. And that represented more than 90% of the entire Danish Jewish population, which was whisked away before the Nazis could send them to Auschwitz and other concentration and death camps.
Yeah. So this boat that the museum now has, how did it come to the museum? I mean, and who's responsible for it?
So we have two local, remarkable human beings, Irene Weiss and Margot Benstock, both of whom had their parents rescued and saved through the boat lift of Danish Jews. And they together found the boat on which Margot's parents were saved.
It's the actual boat that her parents were rescued in?
Yes.
Wow.
And it was still in the water. It was owned by the son of the fisherman who was the captain of the boat who saved her parents and other people. And they guaranteed what its provenance was, purchased the boat, and brought it to our museum and gifted it to us.
You know, it's very interesting. So that now you have, I imagine, an entire exhibit built around this boat and the story of the Danish refugees to Sweden, the rescue of the Danish Jews to Sweden. And it's, in my view, it's interesting that it's such a contrast to the boxcar exhibit that you also have there. You have one of the original boxcars that transported Jews to concentration camp, right?
So, Shelley, you're so correct. The placement of these two very large objects next to each other is very intentional. The boxcar represents fear and death because almost every single person who went into the boxcar, all those Jewish people, were murdered. And the fishing boat, by comparison, represents hope and a future because they were able to get out with the help of an upstander, someone who is not a bystander, someone who is not a victim or a perpetrator, someone who's just an everyday person like you or me, who committed a very brave act to help his fellow citizens.
You know, I can't help but think about the comparisons between what you're talking about, the upstanders in Denmark, and what is going on in Minnesota with the legal observers who call themselves protectors, people who are protecting their community, and I just think it's very interesting that we're talking about the Holocaust today days after, you know, we've suffered this tragedy in Minnesota, I just think that there are things to be learned about today. I think from going to a place like the Holocaust Museum and learning more about that history. That's me, you know, but I would encourage people to go there and to see what the history of the Holocaust Museum shows you in terms of how things didn't happen overnight. You know, the concentration camps, the extermination camps did not happen overnight. It didn't start with death camps. You know, it started with a similar kind of terror and violence that we're seeing in Minnesota, in my view. You know, I don't want to put anybody on the spot to talk about the politics of it, but I do want to talk about the history of it. I think it's important to learn that history and see where it goes. You know what they say, those who don't learn their history are doomed to repeat it. And one of the other important exhibits I think that the museum has available in that regard is its new Elie Wiesel collection. And I'd like to hear more about that, if you wouldn't mind, Eric. Tell us about what the museum has now in terms of the Elie Wiesel collection, what you're going to do with it, how people can engage with it. Talk about that.
Thank you, Shelley. Absolutely. So the Florida Holocaust Museum is honored that the family and the foundation of Elie Wiesel selected our museum to be the holder of his archives, and we are now the world's largest collection of Elie Wiesel artifacts, and we have already created a sneak peek exhibition about Elie Wiesel, both the Holocaust survivor, the icon who's well known for that role, as well as Elie Wiesel, the person, the husband, the father, the grandfather, so that people can understand that this was a human being who they can very much hopefully relate to, and his wife, Marion Wiesel, also a Holocaust survivor, and she is profiled as well, and we are the only museum in the world to include artifacts from Marion Wiesel as part of our permanent collection.
I understand that just last night, in fact, and probably in connection with Holocaust Remembrance Day, a relatively new documentary about the life and work of Elie Wiesel called Soul on Fire premiered on PBS. So if you have access to the PBS channels, you may want to look for it. I'm sure it's going to be aired again over time. But I think it will give people a sense and understanding of how important the Elie Wiesel collection is to the museum, and another way of engaging with the information that you may make available. I understand that the collection, most of it's going to be housed at the USF archive, at the USF library. Is that right?
So actually, we, the Florida Holocaust Museum, have purchased a warehouse which we have named our Collections, Preservation, Research, and Education Facility, and that's where we're going to be housing the vast majority of the Wiesel collection. We also will be, of course, building out the Wiesel experience on the third floor of the Florida Holocaust Museum, which will engage people with an interactive exhibition where they can learn about Elie Wiesel, his life, Marion Wiesel, her life, and most importantly, struggle with ethical dilemmas that we all face in our daily life and what lessons can be learned from Elie Wiesel that can help us to address these ethical dilemmas occurring today.
Yeah, I think that there are some pretty famous quotes, which I'm sure I'm going to mangle, by Elie Wiesel about, if you're saying nothing, if you're silent, you're on the side of the oppressors, or words to that effect, that I think are really poignant today. I have a email here from Karen in Dunedin who says, I will be coming down to see the renovations at the museum. I can't believe it could be any more moving. I walked out sobbing. You know, it's interesting that she says that. I know when I had a visit to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., the construction of it, I think, was very deliberate, so that you start at the top and you walk through and you see the genesis of the Holocaust and the, you know, the anti-Semitism that was so perpetrated and prevalent in Germany, and how it spread, and then you see the decimation of the villages in the Ukraine, for example, and in Poland, and then the rise of the camps, first the slave labor camps, and then the death camps, and then as you proceed through the different tiers of the museum, you come to see the survivors, and you see the liberation of the camps, and you see the survivors, and you see many of them at the end showing up in Israel, or what was then Palestine Mandate, and you know, they come into the sunshine, and you walk out into what appears to be, you know, a much more positive setting. I think that was deliberately done so that people don't necessarily walk out sobbing, or maybe they walk out sobbing in relief, you know. But that's just one viewer's experience of the museum. I've got a call here, if you don't mind. I'm going to take and see a call from one of the anonymous family members in St. Pete. Okay, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for your show, and thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I just wanted to ask what the Florida Holocaust Museum is doing to cover the Holocaust that's taking place across Palestine and Gaza, as well as in the occupied Palestinian territories within East Jerusalem, Silwan, and Sheikh Jarrah. As well as the,
I think we get the
throughout the West Bank.
The gist of your question. Let me ask Mr. Stillman to respond.
I have a two-part question.
Okay. Well, I think we need to get an answer to the first part of your question. I'm going to cut you off because I want to hear from our guest about your question. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Shelley. So the Florida Holocaust Museum really believes in the importance of Holocaust education. And what we do is we teach the lessons of the Holocaust because we think that there are many folks who have not learned the lessons of the Holocaust or forgotten the lessons of the Holocaust, and that we believe it is through teaching the lessons of the Holocaust that we can prevent future genocides and other atrocities. So we are very clear about our mission, our purpose, and we have sections in the museum which talk about lessons for today, and we encourage people to come visit the museum, come see for themselves, and learn from the lessons of the Holocaust and how they can be applied today.
Is there any specific exhibit mention or educational information made available at the museum about what's going on in Israel-Palestine?
Yes, there is. We actually do have a panel. It's in our section called Lessons for Today, which is in the core exhibition, which, as I mentioned, is called History, Heritage, and Hope, which is on the ground level of the museum. And it's interesting, your comment before, Shelley, regarding how the structure of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. is created, where you start at the top of the building and you work your way down. And we designed the Florida Holocaust Museum to start on the ground level and then work your way up to the second and then ultimately to the third level, because we feel that the first or ground level has the most introductory information. The information on the second story of our building contains advanced or further advanced information. Then the third floor, which is where the Wiesel experience will have the most advanced, most detailed information. So we just structured it in a way where people are going to be going up level by level, as opposed to the example in D.C. where they designed it for people to start at the top and go down.
Yeah, I'm in... the design of museums is a really specific thing. I mean, the design of spaces generally. Last year I traveled to Germany and I went to the Nuremberg and I saw the Nuremberg courtroom, for example, and I learned there that it has a connection to Tampa, for example, that the architect who was a member of the military at that time was the same architect / landscape designer that designed one of the parks in downtown Tampa and the one right outside the beer can building. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. And I read an article about him and the work that he did to design the courtroom, which was very specifically designed in certain ways to make sure that because it was going to be televised, was the main reason. Because it was going to be televised, to make sure that it showed the seriousness of it, the gravity of it. And I think it's interesting that museums try to do the same thing, I'm sure, you know, that it's very deliberate in how you design a museum and how you design the exhibits within the museum to get across certain points. So a couple other things I wanted to ask about the museum, and then I'm going to turn to you, Elka, because I think it's important to hear what your organization is doing as well. But the museum offers these teaching trunks as part of its education program. Can you tell us about those? I'm interested to know, what's in these teaching trunks, and are they different for different ages, and what do you do with them?
Absolutely, Shelley. So the teaching trunks program is exactly as you're suggesting, organized with materials based on the ages of the children. So there's one for first and second grade, another for third and fourth, fifth and sixth, and middle school and high school, so forth. And each of these trunks contains instructional material, books, artwork, lesson plans, real substantive material that help the teachers to be able to use the teaching trunk that they receive to impart and teach the lessons of the Holocaust. We also offer teacher training, both in person and virtual. And in addition to that, we also have school groups that come to the museum. We have school groups coming almost every single day of the school year, and that's something where students who are studying the subject matter or looking to learn about the Holocaust can learn. And we have docents who are an incredible set of volunteers who take these students and their teachers and chaperones on the tours. And so we give that experience as well, in addition to the teaching trunks and the teacher training.
And of course, Florida has a law now that mandates a Holocaust education in every classroom, right?
It is fifth through 12th grades. The mandate.
Okay. Yeah. Now, there's one more project I was really interested to hear about, and that is what I thought it was an AI sort of project where you can, where a number of Holocaust survivors, some of whom are no longer with us, gave their testimonies on record. They were videotaped, talking about different things that happened to them during the course of their experience in the Holocaust. And apparently you could go to the museum and they're like a hologram. Yeah, at least that's my understanding. You could ask them questions and that they answer you kind of like a hologram. And I'm just wondering, can you tell us about that project and, how it works? To me, it sounds frankly a little creepy, but I want to know, I want to know what it really is, because it's not necessarily as I've been describing it.
Sure. And to correct a couple of misconceptions. So first of all, there is no artificial intelligence. There is no AI. We do not partake of that whatsoever. What we have are four Holocaust survivors who lived here locally, two of whom are now deceased, two of whom are still alive. They sat, each one, for a week-long series of answering 1,000 questions. Their answers were videotaped, and we are affiliated with the Shoah Foundation from the University of Southern California. It was a program set up by Steven Spielberg after he made Schindler's List. He realized the importance of preserving Holocaust survivor testimony. And so our four local Holocaust survivors sat for those questions. And then the computer system that we have through the Shoah Foundation has a microphone, just like the one I'm talking into right now, and a mouse. And so a visitor, a guest to the Florida Holocaust Museum can go to the microphone, press on the mouse, and ask a question in their own words. And then the computer system recognizes what your question is and figures out which answer from the Holocaust survivor pertains to your question. And then you watch the actual Holocaust survivor answer your question with the actual video footage of their testimony. There is no hologram. There is no AI. It is actual firsthand testimony from Holocaust survivors.
Okay. Well, that kind of clears up the, what it actually is. Was Renee Hammond one of the people who was recorded for that project?
So among the four that we have right now, she is not included. Mm-hmm. However, I can tell you, so Dimensions in Testimony, which is what the program is called, currently, as I said, we have four survivors whose testimony is available. And one of our projects that we will do next is to build out an immersive theater in the building, and that immersive theater will allow many more people to come and participate in talking to and asking questions of the Holocaust survivors rather than the small space that we have available right now.
Okay. All right. Well, the reason I asked about Renee Hammond is because she was one of the survivors that I interviewed at length for this show several years ago, and we played her interview on our show for Holocaust Remembrance Day several years ago. She was a Czech, a Czech national who had been conscripted into many different slave labor camps and during the Holocaust. And sadly, I think she's gone now, right, Elke?
Yes.
Yeah. She was a client of your program, though. And I'd like to hear a little bit about that. Let me just take a phone call before I turn to you. Jack in Dover, you're on the air.
Hi, Shelley. First, I'd like to say thank you for your journalistic expertise. I love the way that you started off with the problems that we're having with ICE and then did a segue into the Holocaust.
I'm not a journalist, though, just let's be clear. I'm not a reporter. I'm just a person with opinions.
Just a person with, I like your style. Let's just put it that way.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. My question to your expert, and this is something that has been bothering me for a long time with regards to the Holocaust, is that I have heard, I don't know where or possibly have read, that that Jewish people were immigrants from a lot of other countries first before they wound up in Germany and then the Holocaust, because the war just couldn't afford to feed them. They were, you know, too busy spending their money on trying to fight the war, the World War. Is there any relevance to those comments that the Jewish people had exhausted every other country aid and then were kind of hoarded up and sent to Germany with the intention of knowing that they wouldn't get any help there and would inevitably die of either starvation or, as it turned out, the Germans just decided to go ahead and, you know, end their suffering?
All right. Well, let me respond to your question, Jack in Dover. Thanks for calling in. First of all, we appreciate your engagement. If I understand what he's asking about, I might suggest that what he may have heard and maybe misinterpreted was about the fact that there was a famine in Ukraine, for example. Now, Ukraine was part of what was called the Pale of Settlement, which was an area that Jews were required to live in for years during, like, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And there was a terrible famine there caused by Stalin. And a lot of people did leave because they we're starving. And also, when the Russian Revolution happened, and communism came to countries like Poland, there was this brief sort of interregnum where Poland was controlled by Russia before the Germans invaded, and then Poland became a state in 1920, an independent state country, an independent country of its own. And so there was all this kind of political upheaval and some violence associated with it that caused people to become refugees. And many of those refugees during that period, before World War II, before Hitler, many of those refugees went west into Germany. They would have gone from Ukraine to Poland to Germany. But they went as refugees, right? I mean, does that make sense?
So unfortunately, I think your caller may be misinformed, because you really have to go back much further in history. For instance, the expulsion of Jews from Spain, that was in
1492. When Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Correct. And that, if you go back much, much further, there have been many other historical incidents where Jews who are considered, were considered other. They were not considered citizens of the countries in which they were residing, were forced out. So there's a long historical pattern which far, far precedes the 20th century.
Right.
And so what I think is really important to understand is that what happened in the Holocaust was horrific and was building up as the Nazis came to power. And so there's a long history to it, which precedes the migration of movements into Germany.
Yeah, I think that's true. I have an email here from Peter. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically he has family members who were Czech and came through Ukraine and wound up being implicated as refugees in World War II. And what I think his point that he, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I think his point is that his family were political refugees. They weren't Jews necessarily. They were political refugees. And I guess it's important to emphasize that, of course, you know, Jews were the largest group of victims of Nazi atrocities in the Holocaust, but they weren't the only group of victims. There were political prisoners who were communists, socialists, Democrats who opposed the Nazis. There were gay people who were victimized. There were the Roma and Sintra people, who some people call gypsies, which I think is kind of pejorative now. So there was a host of other people who were also victims of the Nazis, and I guess his family were among them. I have a call from Kelly in Wesley Chapel. Kelly, make it quick.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, make it quick, please.
Hey, I just wanted to know, I'm the great-granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor myself, and I wanted to know if there's opportunities for volunteering with the museum or working with the museum.
The great question, Kelly. Thank you. Let me talk to our guests. I want to ask you quickly, and also you, Elke, because I know there are volunteer opportunities to work with survivors too.
Yes.
Let's answer Kelly's question.
Sure, Kelly. So the Florida Holocaust Museum does want volunteers. We do appreciate volunteers, including those who are children, grandchildren, and even great grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. And please be in touch with us.
And Elkett, what about Gulf Coast?
At our program, we certainly do welcome volunteers working with our survivors. There's many opportunities. One that's a really simple one is participating in our chats program, where you can speak to a survivor on a weekly basis, just have a friendly chat on a weekly basis to reduce social isolation. We have a number of programs that we engage in throughout the year. So yes, please do connect with us through our webmaster and our website, and we'll be happy to connect you to some of our programming.
Yeah, now let me ask you about your programming. Now, you have a program for Holocaust survivors in the Tampa Bay region. How many people are we talking about now are part of the survivors who are surviving and taking advantage of this program?
So in our region of coverage, which is the Tampa Bay area down to Sarasota and Port Charlotte, we work with roughly 230 survivors. We know there are more people out there for a number of reasons. They may not come forward or request services, but we do have open arms that at any point when someone moves into the region or they've migrated here or they split their time between here and another community, we do have a number of snowbirds, they can reach out to us to have access to our services. Every day is Holocaust Remembrance Day at Gulf Coast JFCS. We work with the survivors, we share their legacy and their memories, and we feel that as good stewards of that history, we work with them to make sure that they have dignity and that their legacy is carried forward.
And part of that, I understand, is supporting them in the activities of daily living. I mean, they're mostly really, really old now, right?
So our youngest survivors are in their mid to late 70s, and our elders certainly are centenarians. And those centenarians, unfortunately, are passing. But we want to assure dignity in their later years. Many Holocaust survivors throughout the United States live in poverty, whereas in their younger years, while they were working, they really didn't want to seek out assistance because they were making ends meet, they were raising their families. But now as elders, where their caregiving needs are greater, their health acuity is tougher, they need those extra hands on, whether it's simple things like cleaning up their homes or taking them to their appointments, shopping for groceries, helping them with their daily health and hygiene. Every single day, we hear more and more need from this population for supports of their basic needs.
And that's part of what your program provides.
Yes, we connect to providers. We make sure they have home care. We make sure they have social connection. One of the simple parts of our program is doing socialization, where we gather Holocaust survivors together for social events within the community, so that they can just speak their language and share experience with their peers that maybe because of the social isolation, they don't see them as frequently as they want. And those are shared experiences that no one else in our community can truly understand. And just getting together to sing songs in their native language, to have a familiar meal, eat latkes at Christmas, those things are really meaningful. While to us, it might just seem like, hey, it's a fun party. For them, it has some really deep meaning in getting in touch with old friends and their culture.
And to live with dignity, many of these survivors want to stay in their homes, don't they? They don't want to go into an institutional setting.
I think that's true of anyone. We want to live independently. We want to live in our home. We want to be surrounded by our friends and family. That's a basic human desire. And so through our program, we try to make sure that as long as folks are able to live independently and stay in their home and stay in familiar settings, we support that and we support their families in pursuing that dream.
Yeah, a lot of them don't want to be in an institutional setting, though, because it's an institutional setting and they have sort of like PTSD from the time that they were, you know, in camps, many of them, or in slave labor circumstances. I think that's another reason, though, that they're particularly against, you know, moving into some sort of institutional setting. But tell us, where do you get your funding, or where do the survivors get their funding?
The bulk of the funding from the program comes from what we call the Claims Conference. They work with the German government to receive stipends on behalf of Holocaust survivors throughout the world. But our group works out of New York. They cover North America and to South America. And each year they go to the German government and renegotiate what those stipends are going to be, which populations are eligible for those services, and what that would cover. Is it basic needs like food, shelter, rent, medical care? Is it home care? Is it recovery? For example, during the hurricanes, we were able to get additional funding to support survivors whose roof blew off during the hurricane or needed additional medication and food because they'd lost their refrigeration. So things like that, where our team speaks to the Claims Conference about the needs of our clients, the growing needs and the changing needs, help us help them inform the German government how best to meet those needs. Now, in the past, those monies came from reparations. Now, German taxpayers pay for those stipends to make sure that there's care given to survivors.
Interesting. And if people wanted to learn more about the program or become a volunteer and maybe even participate in your chats program, which is really like a low commitment kind of way to volunteer that could make a huge difference in people's daily lives, how would they find that program?
I'd encourage folks to go to our website, www.gcjfcs.org, click on the button about Holocaust survivors, or click on the button for volunteerism, and we'll find a match for you.
Okay, great. I had a call here from Caroline who dropped off because we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to quickly talk a little bit about Holocaust education. She wanted to know if there was actually a required curriculum for Holocaust education that is utilized throughout the Florida education system, if the museum has anything to do with that. And I wanted to talk about the fact that, you know, we could fill pages with FBI hate crime statistics about the rise in American anti-Semitism if we wanted to. But, because it's been rising so much in the last certainly 5 years. But some people wonder if it's due to a failure of Holocaust education, the way we educate people, especially young people, about the Holocaust. Not that educating them about the Holocaust itself is bad, but the way we do it. One of the foremost critics of the way we do Holocaust education is the author Dara Horn, who wrote a book called People Love Dead Jews, where she suggests that the way we do Holocaust education is actually making anti-Semitism worse because it presents Jews as passive victims, or what she refers to as dead Jews, rather than reflecting the vibrant culture and traditions that existed both before and after the Holocaust. She suggests that most Holocaust education centers around the idea that bigotry is wrong because all people are essentially similar. She pushes back against this by saying that most attacks on Jews today are on the Hasidic community, which is a subgroup that looks different. You know, they dress differently, they appear different from the average American, for example. And she suggests that it's wrong to teach that bigotry is wrong because people are all alike and all similar. And she suggests that schools need to teach that bigotry is wrong even though people are dissimilar, even though we have diversity. And you shouldn't hate people because they're just like you and me. You should not hate people because they're people. That's one of the criticisms that she has. And I wonder what your response to these questions are.
So, Shelley, I think that Dara Horn misses the mark in terms of understanding about Holocaust education in a couple of important ways. First, at the Florida Holocaust Museum, for instance, we do, in fact, emphasize the stories of individuals because, 6 million is just an incredibly large number, and so you really have to talk about individual by individual. And we have Holocaust survivors who have testimony. We have individuals who are the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. So we do have very much stories to tell of and by living Jews. And so I think that's a misconception that Dara Horn has. And second, to really understand about the fact that Jews and other partisans did fight back in World War II and against the Holocaust in ways that they could, it's important for Dara or anybody else who's listening to come visit the Florida Holocaust Museum, see our exhibition, History, Heritage, and Hope. And in our core exhibition, we speak to exactly this point. We think Holocaust education is very effective, and we have recently been taught the research that shows how to make it even more effective by giving students and others more time with the artifacts, hearing from survivors, and hearing their testimony. So we do believe we know how to move the needle to improve Holocaust education in a way that will reduce anti-Semitism, because Holocaust education is an underutilized tool in our toolbox of fighting anti-Semitism.
Does the museum have any direct role in creating the curriculum that's used throughout Florida in Holocaust education programs?
So the Florida Holocaust Museum is recognized by the state. We are, in fact, working with the Department of Education. We provide the materials and our teaching trunks and our teacher training programs. We are, in fact, a very instrumental partner with the state in Holocaust education, which is mandated, as we talked about before, in 5th through 12th grades here in Florida.
Okay. I know also that the museum, I don't know if you still have it, but at one time you had this exhibit about the Bielski brothers, which was a family that basically rescued Jews and helped them survive in the woods outside of where the Nazi cordon was rounding them up and taking them to extermination camps. And that's another example of not Jews not passively, you know, going to their death and actually having some agency in what happened to them. Because I know one of her other criticisms is that the use of, like, Anne Frank or Anne Frank's diary, for example, as sort of a universal story of hope, doesn't really reflect the reality, which, of course, you know, she died. She died in a concentration camp. And so talking about Anne Frank's diary as a universal story of hope, I still believe in the goodness of people, or whatever the quote is kind of deceptive. Because in the end, it avoids the specific irrational nature of anti-Semitism and her fate, right?
So, Shelley, I think what visitors will find when they come to the Florida Holocaust Museum is that we have a much richer, much more nuanced education about what occurred in the Holocaust, what lessons can be taken from the Holocaust, and with the building out of the Wiesel experience, we will have an entire third floor of what Elie Wiesel can teach us and the lessons from Elie Wiesel that are very applicable today.
All right. I also know that your former chair of your board is on the Florida State Holocaust Education Committee that was created by Governor DeSantis to develop and put forward the curriculum that's being used in Florida schools, right?
That is correct, and we are very instrumental partners in Holocaust education throughout the state of Florida, and not just in our region, but across the whole state.
Okay, if people want to learn more about the museum or opportunities to volunteer there or specific exhibits that you have, how can they find that information?
Well, the easiest way is they can go on our website, which is thefhm.org. They can also call us, and they can absolutely come and visit us.
And are you open on Saturday too? Because I know that's, yeah.
We are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Okay. All right. Well, that's about all we have time for today, friends. Talking about bigotry, it seems appropriate to mention here that the rise of the far right has brought an assault on history. We're fortunate to have our friends here from the Holocaust Museum and the Survivor Program at Gulf Coast Jewish and Family Services with us to talk about that particular history. But in Florida, we also have history that I think is important to focus on, and monuments glorifying secessionists are still being restored in Florida now. After they were removed, they're now being brought back. Florida middle schoolers are being taught that slavery actually offered benefits to the enslaved. So what is the future of history in Florida? Well, WMNF wants to find out more. So I encourage you to join us on Tuesday, February 10th at the Commodore Club in Ybor City for Wavemakers Live for a very provocative conversation with two of Florida's most distinguished historians, Ray Arsenault, who wrote the history of the Freedom Riders during the Civil Rights Movement, and Gary Mormino, who is the author of an award-winning history of modern Florida. They will be in conversation on February 10th at the Commodore Club. You can get tickets on our website. It's $10 in advance, $15 on the day of. Thanks to my guests, Eric Stillman from the Florida Holocaust Museum and Elke Cumming from Gulf Coast. Thanks to the WMNF volunteers, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling. Our next big fundraiser is coming up next month, and I would love to be able to thank you on air for a generous contribution when we kick off our pledge drive on February 18th. If you like what we do here on Midpoint, please direct your contribution to us or to MPW on the drop-down menu on the WMNF website. Now stay tuned for Talking Animals after the NPR News. We are WMNF Tampa, and we are out. Time is through the waste.